And in amongst all the other announcements, I did forget to mention a huge welcome to our guests today. We have I was going to say Henry's son, but I'm pointing at you. Terrell and Henry's son and their family from Toowoomba. And we have some folks up the back. I didn't get a chance to say good day beforehand, but welcome. You guys aren't visitors anymore, so it's really nice to have you here. But yeah, just welcome everybody. Coming around the word, and as a window into what we're talking about today, I'd just like to read a couple of verses from Mark chapter 10, where Jesus replied, and he says, "At the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate." I watched the news the other night, and I've got to admit that, not for the first time, but once again, I felt shame of the fact that I'm in Australia and Australian. I watched as our Parliament, first of all, they were going to take a vote just on voices, as they often do in Parliament. But then somebody said, no, we want our parliamentarians to actually say what they're really saying, not just to hide behind a curtain of voices. And so they called for a division in the House. And those of you who are watching saw four men, four parliamentarians, stand up and say, "We vote no." And the rest of the Parliament went across to the other side and euphorically celebrated the fact. But in Australia now, by law, we have adopted a policy of gross immorality and declared that it is now not only acceptable, but by the time the show is finished, it's going to be almost compulsory. I've got to admit, I was ashamed. See, Australia had a vote on it. I wasn't terribly surprised with the outcome, seeing that the debate beforehand had been so completely one-sided. And they made it very, very loud declarations that they weren't to have any hate speech. And hate speech was defined as anybody speaking out the truth for what was actually being proposed. And so our Parliament rushed through this shameful change to our laws without any proper debate, upper house or lower house, and celebrated the passage of a law, a whole series of laws that are going to follow on, with only that handful making a moral stand, having the guts to vote against this shameful day in our Australian history. In 5 years' time, I suspect that a lot of us will be seriously regretting what has happened. And generations to follow will look back on this day and say, "Where did we go wrong?" And so with this in mind, I thought just for today, I know I'm preaching to the converted, I understand that. But sometimes we need to clarify within our own minds, what do we really understand? What do we really believe in? It's interesting, when the results of the plebiscite came in, there are some postcodes, and they were able to identify the postcode areas that the votes had come from, and some postcode areas were acknowledged as being very strongly Christian based. Other postcode areas are recognised as being anything but. But when the plebiscite results came in, there wasn't very much difference between the two. It seems that Christians don't even know what God thinks about the issues of marriage. And so today I just want to spend a few minutes talking about God's view of marriage and why is it so important. Some time ago I was told of the story of, it wasn't a story, it was something that happened. A couple had decided they would like to have their infant child baptized and went and saw their minister, and the minister started interrogating the couple, and he decided that because she was one denomination, he was another, she was baptized, he wasn't, then they weren't properly married, even though they had stood at the front of the church and signed the papers and done. He declared that they weren't properly married, and because they weren't properly married, then he wasn't going to baptise their child. And in that particular denomination, the theory was that if you haven't been baptised, then you go to hell. He was happy to assign a child to hell because he didn't... What's God's view on marriage? What's God's view on all of that? I've got to admit, I was horrified when I heard about it, because I know that God's view on marriage is very, very different to that. So we start out by asking, and if this clicker will work for me, it'll be wonderful, otherwise I'm going to have somebody to help me. No, it's not going to work. Can you pull me through to the next one, please? I'll just tell you when we're going. We start by asking, what is marriage? And spend a bit of time discussing what's not marriage. And we ask the question, why is it so important for us? And how does it affect us? Now, please understand, I'm not having a shot at anybody. We recently started doing my family history. And tucked away inside there, my dear grandmother, who I never knew as a young lady, I only knew her as a much older lady. But when I started digging through my family history, I discovered that my grandmother had actually married a gentleman over in England. They had a baby together, but then sometime later she fell pregnant, but her husband wasn't father of the child. Her husband was not happy with the situation, and she eventually left and came to Australia. She arrived in Australia, pregnant young lady, and met up with a bloke by the name of John Hovey, and she decided that he was a bit of all right, and they ended up shacking up together for the rest of their lives. They were never ever married. We didn't find out. She changed her name. She was Mrs. Hovey, but they never ever got married. And suddenly realised that, hang on, you've probably got some things in your family tree and might even have things in our lives as well. But please, I'm not trying to have a shot at anybody. I'm just saying we need to understand, what is God's view in all of that? What is married life? And the definition I've got, man and woman living their wedded lives together. I'd like to add into that, that living their lives together in harmony with each other and in harmony with God. But that's another story. Now, if you're going to have a marriage, then first of all it starts out with... we got it. It starts out with a wedding. And a wedding actually has a number of components. There's two that I've identified as being spiritual, and then there's three of... in the natural side. Now, first of all, we need to understand the natural understanding. A wedding involves a man and a wife. It doesn't involve a man and his dog, his cow, his car, TV, or best mate from school. It is very clearly understood. God's eye view of marriage is it is between a man and a wife. Now, how a marriage works is different in every culture. We recognize that. And different cultures have different ways of starting out in their married life. There's all sorts of benefits involved, although this has been clouded when they gave the same benefits to de facto relationships as they do to marriage. But there's been tax benefits. The spouse is not allowed, not required, cannot be asked to give evidence against her or his partner. There's pension benefits. There's automatic succession unless something has been deliberately written into a will. All of those things. And the homosexual lobby was deliberately targeting those benefits. In actual fact, those benefits had long been transferred across to them if they were in some sort of a permanent relationship. So let's have a look quickly at the components in the marriage. First of all, if we can go to the next one, the spiritual one. In Genesis 2, verses 18 to 25, we read about the fact that God declares, "For this cause a man will leave his father and his mother." So the first component is making sure that we have left our old family. I've known, actually, it's hard being honest about this, but us boys are tending to be a little bit susceptible if we're not careful. We love our mothers. There is a special relationship between a son and mother. And very easy for mother to take advantage of that relationship and control a marriage. And the boy has never, ever quite got round to leaving his mother. Of course, I was never like that. I didn't have a great deal of success telling Margie that she should hang her sheets on the line the way mother said. I didn't have a great deal of success telling her that mum used to cook potatoes in a particular way. And mum had even less success trying to tell Margie, but I've got to admit that it took a little while for me to wake up that while she was my mother and I honoured her, Margie was my wife. And the rule is, Margie has more right to be wrong in my house than mum has to be right. So even though I thought that mum was right in the way she hung the sheets out, she had very good reasons why they were hung out, Margie had more right to be what I thought was wrong. She had more right to do that. We have to leave our old relationship. It changes dramatically. But if we try and hang on to that relationship and put it in front of our marriage, I'm sorry, God speaks against it. But the next step is, not only do we leave, but we cleave to our wife. Binds us together with a spouse and a new family. And it involves totally joining together. There's physical joining, there's property, there's financial. At one stage, they had a marriage ceremony where the husband was making a declaration that was indicating that he wasn't really taking her on board. And so all of my worldly goods I share. Of course, some husbands like to share 90%, 10% for her, or whatever. Guess what? In godly marriage, we endow. Margie owns 100% of our assets. 100%. I own 100% of our assets. We have no delineation of what is mine and what is hers. But if I find her playing my trumpet, there's going to be some problems. Actually, I suggest, Margie's saying she finds me playing the her piano accordion, there really will be problems for the neighbours. Seriously, how many of you went through, before you got married, how many of you went through marriage counselling? Okay, a few of you, not many. How many of you in that marriage counselling spent serious time talking about financial issues? Not many at all, because for some reason it isn't considered important, but it is. So, all right, there is a leaving and a cleaving, but then we come to the marriage more common that we know about, the natural ways. And of course this does vary according to laws and cultures around the world. Every culture has a different way of doing things. I love the Tanzanian way of conducting a marriage, the traditional way of conducting a marriage. Our African friends will have to say yes or no whether it applies within their situation. But within the Sukuma people, the people that we were working with, within Sukuma people, first of all, there was a big event as we negotiated bride price. That was more important than the actual wedding. When it came time for the wedding, there would be two stools placed and everybody would be standing around and rejoicing. The bride would come in and take her place sitting on one of the stools, and then the groom would come in and take his place sitting on the stool beside her. He would hold his arm out, he would take her arm, and they are now married. Simple. Effective. But, okay, they didn't do marriage the way we do, but for them, the marriage started with that wedding ceremony. So, if we go and have a look at the way that we do our weddings, and I believe this also ties in with a godly way, first of all, we make vows, we make pledges to each other. And these are done before witnesses and before God. Passages I read before. At the beginning of creation, God made the male and female. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. So they are no longer two but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. I was at a wedding one time, and it was a marriage celebrant was doing it, and the young man was a bit of a rouse about, he's a bit of a character, and the celebrant said to him, do you take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife? And he said, yeah, I suppose I do. And she stopped and she said, we're going to try that again. We don't suppose we do. The correct answer is yes, I do, or no, I don't. Nothing else. Thank you very much. Now, do you take it? I'm sorry, it's not a joking matter. When people turn up thinking that a marriage is just a bit of a show, I'm sorry, it's not. This is a very, very serious thing. It is the beginning of a marriage. We then go through the process of signing the documents, and it's a very important part here in Australia because that is how the government recognises that a marriage has been taken place. This is the beginning of the marriage, this is the wedding. Now, some people say, oh, it's only a piece of paper. Well, I'm happy with that idea, because if it's only a piece of paper, then I'm happy to sell them a car. And I'll write out the receipt, accept their money, and then the next day I'll go and pick up their car. Well, pick up my car, I'll take it back again. And they'll argue with me and say, no, you wrote out a receipt. And I'll say, it's only a piece of paper, don't worry about it, I'll have my car back, thank you. No, a piece of paper, when we've signed a name on it, is something that is very, very meaningful. And when we, in front of witnesses, are signing, then it is something very, very serious. As a matter of fact, 1 Peter chapter 2, 13, 14 points out the necessity of us agreeing with and working within the confines of the law of the land. Submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men, whether to the king as the supreme authority or to the governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. Submit ourselves to the laws of our land. And then the final part of the marriage. Hello, we've done the witnesses, we've done the pledges. Might need to move it on for me, please. Got it? Okay. Back one. Just a little bit slower. Okay. Third part, the natural part, the consummation of a marriage. A marriage is not... A wedding is not a wedding until we have made the vows, signed the papers, and the wedding has been consummated. The act of love is the final seal on that marriage, and it reflects the loving consummation of Christ and his bride. Actually, there's a very, very interesting little piece in John chapter 3. Now, we're all familiar with John chapter 3, John 3:16, Nicodemus, all of that. But if you keep reading towards the end of it, you find it breaks into a new little passage. And when you get down to about verse 16, 18, I'm sorry, no, I'm wrong place. Near the end of the chapter, 27 to 30. And it turns out that Jesus and his disciples were in ministry, crowds were coming, and it turns out that some of Jesus' disciples were actually baptizing people in the River Jordan. Some of the Pharisees, some of the religious leaders, came to John the Baptist and said to John the Baptist, "Hey, what's going on here? You have been baptizing. Now Jesus is over there baptizing. He was the one that you said, and they're actually baptizing more than you." And I think they were trying to stir up some trouble. And John the Baptist made a point that the bridegroom, I'll just read it, the bride belongs to the bridegroom. This is how he described what was happening. "The friend who attends the bridegroom waits and listens for him and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom. That joy is mine and it is now complete. He must become greater, I must become less." You're looking at me strange and saying, "Well, what does that have to do with what we're talking about?" There's a very interesting little thing that took place within the culture. You see, a wedding, Jewish wedding, took place over a fairly lengthy period of time, anything up to a week. It started off with the bridegroom coming and kidnapping his bride from her father's house. He would take her away to his father's house, and there all the guests would be waiting to celebrate. But when they got to the father's house, the bridegroom has prepared a special room, and he would take the bride and go into that special room by themselves. All the rest of the guests are outside just chit-chatting, talking away to themselves. Some music might be playing in the background, but the actual wedding feast has not begun and will not begin, because in the privacy of that room, the bride and the groom come together in marriage intimacy. Now, until that time, the bride and the groom have hardly seen each other for a lengthy period of time. But the groom has had a friend who has maintained contact on his behalf, brings messages to her. "Yes, it's nearly ready. is getting the place ready. It's all coming on. How are you going? Do you have everything you need? Can he arrange for some help for you? And so the friend became fairly close to the bride. As a matter of fact, by the time it was finished, the bride can hardly remember the groom, but can only remember the friend. But now, on the day of the wedding, she is with her beloved. And they are in a room by themselves and sharing a time of intimacy. He has prepared this room. He might have some nice candles. He'll have beautiful decorations. He might have something nice to eat, or all of those things. And eventually, the marriage is consummated. All of the time that that is happening, there is a small hole in the door with a little, what do we call it, a cover across it, that can only be opened from the inside. Standing beside the door, not with the rest of the crowd, but standing beside the door, friend, somebody who can be trusted completely. And he just stands there and waits and waits and waits. And eventually, the bridegroom comes and opens the door and whispers outside, "You can tell them they can start the celebration. She is no longer my bride. She is my wife." The consummation is a very, very important part. And there have been times where marriages have fallen apart because there's been an unwillingness to come together in the intimacy. Okay, let's move on. Let's ask the question, what's not a marriage? And a marriage isn't a marriage if it hasn't started with a wedding. And a wedding is not a wedding if it doesn't have those three factors involved. It's only a pretense. For instance, if you have a mock wedding, and sometimes people have a mock wedding at a party or something like that. I'm sorry, they can stand at the front, they can say all sorts of nice things, all of that, but it's not a wedding, is it? It's only people play acting. It's only a mock. If there's no signing of papers, then they sign the papers, but they don't make the vows to each other. It's not a wedding. They can go through making the vows, they can go through signing the papers, but if there's no consummation, there's no wedding. So what's not a marriage? And any union that doesn't start with a proper marriage, wedding, I'm sorry, it's not a marriage. Just shacking up together. Even the point, like my grandparents who were together for many, many, many years. I'm sorry, not a marriage. Actually, Jesus summed it up for us in John chapter 4. When he told the Samaritan woman at the well, "Go and call your husband and come back." "I don't have a husband," she replied. And Jesus said, "You're right when you say you have no husband. Fact is, you've had no five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true." It's actually a modern tragedy, isn't it? Our laws have now clouded the issues, granting the rights of de facto after time together. So now they're half married, children only half parented. They may or may not inherit the parents' name. I was just reading a case recently of a couple who are going through high court in America because she wanted to make sure that the child inherited her name only, and he wanted to have the baby named after him. and they decided, the court decided they would hyphenate the name, and neither of them were happy with that outcome, and they took it to a higher court, and it's being fought right the way through. And of course, with the de facto thing, there is a concept that if somebody nicer comes along, it's interesting how many people are happy to live in that sort of a relationship. If somebody nicer comes along, I'm free to go. But if the partner decides somebody nicer has come along, they get all upset about it. They want that right for themselves, but not for somebody else. And how often violence comes as part of it. Malachi chapter 2, God simply says, I hate divorce. People think that God's angry with us. No, God is angry with divorce. God doesn't hate divorcees, because too often they are victims of the way our culture operates. And God sees the damage that is done in people's lives. How many times people have gone through divorce and 5 years later said, if only I had known how much this was going to cost me financially and emotionally, I'd have never gone through with it. God hates divorce because he sees that pain. So in all of this, we ask the question, what is our role as a church? Seems that the world's lost its way totally. So what can we do to help? Can I suggest that we need to be supportive? Even people that are doing things that we might disagree with. It's not an unforgivable sin. And you and I aren't all that perfect anyhow. And we need to be there to help and support. We need to be unashamedly pointing to the truth. We also need to be demonstrating the value of God's love within our lives. So we ask the question, why is all of this so important? You see, in the heavenly realm, things on earth very often are a mirror of something that is in the heavenlies. So I might go back a little bit from there. I've gone too far, I'm afraid. Yep, there we go. In the heavenly realm, for instance, the temple on earth is a reflection of something in the heavenly. The sacrificial lamb on earth was only a mirror image of the perfect. And if we look at the mirror image here, what we see in the lower part is very, very nice, but it's only a mirror image of what is above. And within the marriage, there is a mirror image of the relationship between Christ and the church. In Ephesians chapter 5, wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body, of which he is the Saviour. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives. Just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. So husbands, we are called to be a mirror image in our relationship with our wife of the relationship that Jesus has to his church. Now, I haven't quite got there yet. I've got a long, long way to go, but that's the direction I want to be heading. And as we do that, we are carrying out what God has planned for us in our lives. In the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own body. He who loves his wife loves himself. God takes the marriage issue very, very seriously. As a matter of fact, when the children of Israel came out of Egypt, the culture had been so polluted over a couple of hundred years within Egypt, that God had to teach them how to live. And in teaching them how to live, he gave them the Ten Commandments. And he gave them a whole bunch of other teachings so that they could establish proper lives. Matter of fact, he took marriage so seriously. There was death penalty for violation. Deuteronomy 22:22, if a man is found sleeping with another man's wife, both the man who slept with her and the woman must die. You must purge yourself from this evil in your country. Marriage is also very important as far as God is concerned. He considers marriage to be more important than national security. Get this, it's interesting. In Deuteronomy 24, verse 5, it says, if a man has recently married, he must not be sent to war or have any other duty laid on him. For one whole year, he is to be free to stay at home and bring happiness to the wife he has married. Whoa, does that sound like a good idea? As far as God is concerned, a country where marriage, where wives don't know for a fact that they are deeply loved by their husbands, in a country where that has fallen apart, is not worth fighting for. And obviously, after the 12 months of being home and caring and loving with his wife and family, he's going to be much more deliberate as a soldier defending his country. Satan hates the picture of godly marriage. He will attack marriage as every possible chance he can. You propose counterfeit marriages. You'll cause unfaithfulness in marriages. He will urge relationships based on casual, shallow infatuation, not on love. He'll encourage casual relationships. No care, no responsibility, just momentary pleasure. He will happily undermine godly marriage with those things. Not only that, but within a marriage there's offspring. God cares for our kids and wants for them to have the very best possible start in life. And two caring parents, man and woman, act as wonderful role models for them. Get a picture of this, Malachi chapter 2. Another thing you do, you flood the Lord's altar with tears, you weep and wail because he no longer pays attention to your offerings or accepts them with pleasure from your hands. You ask, why? Why isn't God answering my prayers? It is because the Lord is acting as the witness between you and the wife of your youth, because you have broken faith with her, though she is your partner, the wife of your marriage covenant. Has not the Lord made them one? In flesh and spirit they are his. And why one? Because he is seeking godly offspring. So guard yourself in your spirit. Do not break faith with the wife of your youth. And of course, it's also true of our spiritual offspring. And if you've been involved in ministry in any way at all, been involved in leading people to the Lord or discipling people or helping people, and then suddenly a marriage breaks down, it causes problems for those people who are watching. Last but not least, a physical relationship. Is far, far deeper than just the physicality of it. There is a spiritual part there as well. Paul was talking to the church in 1 Corinthians. They were a bit of a wild group. And he says to them, everything is permissible for me, you say, But I say to you, not everything is beneficial. You say everything is permissible for me, but I say I will not be mastered by anything. Food for the stomach and stomach for the food, which was another way of saying God made me a male, therefore I can go out and do whatever I like. But God will destroy them both. For body is not meant for immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. By his power God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? Shall I then take the members of Christ and unite them with a prostitute? Never. Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it says, the two become one flesh. But he who unites himself with the Lord is one with him in body. Satan wants us to become involved with the pagan spirit. He wants to destroy marriage, and within the culture of the world, people are being encouraged to unite themselves physically and spiritually with virtually anybody that goes past. Our marriage bond is a very, very sacred thing. Hebrews 13 verse 4, marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. So in this contaminated world, we ask God's help to keep our hearts clean, to build strong, loving relationships. Margie and I were over at the Gold Coast. We were replenishing some of the supplies, some of the kitchen things that had been borrowed at the same time as they borrowed my trumpet. It was interesting because one of the shops we'd gone to, we'd picked out whatever it was we needed, took it across to a couple of girls at the counter, and they were working out what had to be, and it turned out they needed some paperwork. The girl had to go out, one of the girls had to go out the back and fix things up, and a bit of messing around, and there's nobody else there, just two girls at the counter chatting. And we happened to comment that what we were buying was because of the stuff that had been stolen. That was sad. It was terrible. Yeah, it was a bit of a pain. But I said to them, the thing that hurts most wasn't so much the valuable items. It wasn't so much, you know, the kitchen stuff and so on. The thing that really hurt was some of the things that were special just to Margie and myself. She was the sweetest little 15-year-old you've ever seen in your life. She was so cute. Still is. I could be cooking my own tea tonight. I love her. However, I was 16. I got my first job. Very, very low wage. And Margie's birthday was coming up, and I decided, and I saved up and saved up, and I went down to the jewelers, and they had a really, really nice brooch. It was only glass, cut glass, but for me, it was way out there. And I bought that for her and gave it to her for her birthday, and we've had it ever since. Can you understand that there was a bit of a feeling about that when it got flogged off? We've got pictures of Margie at home with the brooch on, but that's all. And I was just sharing this briefly with the girls. They were near opposite ends of the counter, just listening as we were talking. And both of them had the same reaction. One broke down in tears, and the other one was very close to it. The 25, 30-ish. And they said, we have been robbed. We don't have any memories like that. at all. We've had a succession of boyfriends. Slept with them, shacked up with them, lived up with them. We've moved on, they've moved on. But we don't have any precious memories from our young days as young girls. The sad memories. I felt like weeping with them. But our Aussie culture allows the preciousness of loving, lasting marriages to be demeaned to the point that our young people very seldom get to experience that joy. God help us. Now, I realize I'm talking to a group of people, and many of you have fallen foul of exactly the same sorts of things. I do know this. There is no thing that God's love and grace doesn't forgive. So whether you've fallen foul or not, we can come to Him and say, God, forgive me, and ask for His healing. But then we can start talking very, very positively about God's view of marriage in our lives and within our culture. Heavenly Father, I pray that You seal Your word within our hearts. Pray that You give to us an understanding of Your great love for us and Your great desire for nothing but the very, very best for us as individuals, for our families. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.